Welcome to episode 3 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode, it's a little bit different, Greg.
It's new for us.
So what we've done is we have asked our three sons to choose three films which they love. So the first film which we're going to discuss, which was chosen by Greg's youngest son, Sebastian, is 1977's Star Wars.
And then we're going to talk about the film chosen by Ricardo's son, Cass, who has chosen 2018's Ready Player One.
And for the final film, chosen by Greg's oldest son, Teo, will be 1995's The Usual Suspects.
Now, you've forgotten to mention one very important thing, Ricardo, which is we're not discussing these just between the two of us as per usual. We've actually invited each son in as our first ever podcast guest to talk to us about their film.
Which is fantastic and quite exciting. I'm really excited about
it. And important to mention.
So our first film is 1977's Star Wars, chosen by Greg's youngest son, Sebastian. Welcome, Sebastian.
Hello there. It's great to be here today.
So let's kick it off. And Greg, talk to us about Star Wars.
I feel like a part of history, as I was in a front row seat at one of the original 1977 screenings of this George Lucas film in Australia, which is something, Ricardo, I know that you cannot claim. And I well remember marvelling at the opening shot of the huge Star Cruiser flying over my head. Back then, youngsters, we just called it Star Wars, but let's recognise its full contemporary name, Star Wars: A New Hope, Episode 4. It's basically a western mixed with an adventure film set in space. A farm boy out in the boondocks goes on a quest to rescue a princess from her kidnappers. He's guided by an older man with a mysterious backstory. They form a posse, which includes a seasoned gunslinger type and comedy relief sidekicks, to rescue the princess and then destroy the bad guy's fortress. But in space. With lightsabers instead of swords, which is an innovative touch. On the surface, it's a simple story, but it's one that struck a chord that has rung down the generations, as evidenced by my son here, who is quite the Star Wars fan. Perhaps it's because this is a film that knows its audience and targets them squarely. It was the first blockbuster that really created its own universe and then built steadily on it, much like the Marvel films of today. It's certainly helped by sound casting choices. Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker looks so fresh-faced and innocent as the farm boy, yet it's a very confident performance. Carrie Fisher is perfect as the sassy princess in a career-defining performance. Harrison Ford has a role that was made for him and launched his career as the capable yet imperfect wisecracking dude, which has served him so well in such other roles as Indiana Jones. Sir Alec Guinness gives a measured and assured performance as the mentor, Obi-Wan Kenobi, despite his misgivings about doing a film of, quote, fairy tale rubbish. Peter Cushing is also good as the commander of the Death Star, and James Earl Jones' bass voice is a terrific choice for lead baddie Darth Vader. There are also some startling cameos, such as Dennis Lawson from TV's New Tricks as Rebel Pilot Wedge, and Australian Play School host Peter Sumner as a baddie. I haven't seen this film since it first came out, and what surprised me this time around is how terribly clean and bright everything was, particularly for a film from the 70s. I know that the film has been digitally enhanced and altered in the last 40 years, but I think it was also the simplicity of the sets that seemed much less detailed than what we've become used to in sci-fi movies over the decades since. I also found that I'd misremembered the film's structure. The posse doesn't leave Luke's home planet until just at the halfway mark, and they only reach the rebel base 20 minutes before the end, just long enough to identify and execute their mission to destroy the Death Star. For an action film, the story is very slow to get going after the opening battle and capture of the princess. And yet, conversely, the film's end is quite abrupt, as though it doesn't care about the characters once the action is over. I have to say that I'm not the biggest Star Wars fan, although I've seen all the major films because, well, you just do. And because I love my son and like to share activities with him. But I'm more of a fan of sci-fi that seeks to tackle deeper questions such as TV's Star Trek or even Doctor Who. So, Sebastian, tell us, why did you choose this film and what did you think of it this time around?
I chose Star Wars because it's probably one of my favourite franchises. And although it's not my favourite, it's very good for a film made in 1907. And although the effects have been altered over recent times, it's very, very good, in my opinion.
It is. It was, you know, it's my birth year. It was actually made in my birth
year. I wasn't going to quite say that. And you look pretty good for something made in 1977 too, Ricardo.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I do believe that in the original script of A New Hope, I don't think that Luke and Leia were cast as brother and sister. I think that was only thought out either after or when they're making Empire Strikes Back. But it can be seen sometimes as Luke and Leia give each other affectionate looks, and a conversation between Han and Luke about Luke asking if Princess Leia would go for a guy like him.
It's quite clear that Luke is eyeing off Han Solo as a potential competitor for the hand of the princess, not knowing, as you say...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, not knowing, as you say, at that stage, that they're brother and sister. Or who their father is. Da, 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 yeah. Da,
this is such a great movie. I don't think it's the best of the series by any stretch.
What do you think's the best?
But I think The Empire Strikes Back is the best.
So, Sebastian, you've got a different choice, haven't you?
Yeah, my favourite's Revenge of the Sith.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I like it for some of the same reasons some people might like Empire Strikes Back. I like it because it's got a bit of a dark ending.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
And, like, it all ties up into A New Hope quite well, in my opinion.
You're right. I think it's the best of the prequels. I mean, we're going to talk about Star Wars here, but, I mean, we have to sort of talk about the universe. I mean, you really can't talk about this first film without everything as well. The original trilogy is the best trilogy, I think. A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi.
No, I'm not a fan of Return of the Jedi. I got quite bored of it.
Oh,
I agree.
Goodness,
I think
no.
Empire Strikes Back is the best of the bunch.
Yeah.
But no,
yeah,
Revenge of the Jedi, I remember at the time Revenge I couldn't watch it.
Return of the Jedi.
But Return of the Jedi, I remember I really struggled to watch it.
Oh my goodness. So that was my favourite growing up, actually. I loved the whole the sand... what do they call it? The sand pit where people fall in and digest for 1,000 years.
The Sarlacc pit.
The Sarlacc pit, which they ruined.
He knows this
they
stuff.
They ruined, yeah, which is great. But they ruined that in the update. I mean, in the original, it's just one big hole with teeth. And that's scary. You fall in a pit and you digest for 1,000 years, right? Whereas the new one, they had this, they did the digitally altered one, they put these flower things which come up and grab you, which just ruined it. It wasn't a hole which you fell into anymore. It was just this big creature. And I just thought they ruined that. In fact, I love the updates. In Star Wars, they add these creatures in the background. I know many people were unhappy with Greedo shooting first, because in the original, Han shot first. Which was his character. I mean, people thought it just ruined the beginnings of his character because he shot first. He's very selfish, Han. And so that's...
Well, he grows over the course of the trilogy.
But at the very beginning, he will do anything to get what he wants. But I think Lucas toned that down in the altered versions or the upgraded versions. In Return of the Jedi, they added these... really this weird dance sequence with these weird characters in the Jabba the Hutt section, which I thought was a bit... But overall, I thought they did a good job with it, and it did need an update. I think the restoration of Star Wars looks beautiful, and I watched it on Disney Plus. You know, what they've done to it is great.
You know, it's only just occurred to me, but Han Solo's narrative arc, until, you know, the big hurrah at the end of this first film, you know, Episode 4... he is very clearly going to leave them all behind. He's here for the money, and now he's off. But what turns him around isn't, in fact, the princess. It's Luke. Luke is... Luke's idealism and youth is what actually changes Han.
I would agree with you. Luke is a very big, movable man who moved Han to come back and help. Although I think love for the princess was a factor, it wasn't such a big thing then. It only really became a thing in Empire Strikes Back.
I honestly don't care about the updates or not. I understand what you're saying about the change in character, and that's fairly significant. I think it makes sense that at the end of the third film, when Luke sees the ghosts of Obi-Wan and Anakin Skywalker, they replace that older actor with Hayden... What's his name?
Christensen. They shouldn't have done that. No.
Oh, I think they should have.
No.
Because that's the character you had got to know.
It doesn't matter. They should have just left it. Because when you look at Darth Vader, I don't know.
Did you both?
I kind of like the original. I kind of like the original the way they did that.
Did you both know that George Lucas actually was a farm boy?
I think so. Yeah.
He grew up on a walnut farm.
Yeah, I think there's he has a farm place. He has a house on a farm, I think.
Yeah.
And sometimes he invites people over to view.
You know, he hasn't actually made that many films, because I checked into it.
No.
He made various shorts, including the THX 1138, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's, yeah.
And then he made American Graffiti, and then he made...
Which is great.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, American Graffiti's wonderful.
And then he made the 4 Star Wars films, and that's it. You know, adjunct TV specials and kind of explanation things for the Star Wars story. But he really only has made 5 feature films. And yet when I think George Lucas, I think like Steven Spielberg. Spielberg's made dozens of films.
Oh, 57 or something. Like
really?
That,
yeah. Okay. And Lucas really has made 4. That was to me a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, well, no, he hadn't. And he decided to direct the prequels. And the prequels were...
Yeah.
I remember in 98 when Phantom Menace was coming out. I mean, that was a huge deal. And the thing is, I'm not that harsh on the Phantom Menace. I don't mind the Phantom Menace, actually. I think it's better than Attack of the Clones, I think. I think they use more sets in there rather than too much CGI. I think in Attack of the Clones, they went too far the other way towards CGI. People didn't like Jar Jar Binks in the Phantom Menace, and I get it. It's a bit of an annoying character, but I'll tell you what, but kids loved Jar Jar Binks. They loved them. I mean, it didn't suit the older people who loved the original trilogy. They're all grown up.
And we're turning it into canon,
that's right. But the thing is, the original series was made when they were that young. So Ewoks, when they loved them, Ewoks were great back then. And so I think it was harshly criticised.
For the uninitiated, the Ewoks are those little teddy bear creatures.
Yeah, yeah. They're great. I loved them when I was a kid, you know. So... I think it's harshly criticised. I think it's a better film. And I think Liam Neeson as Qui-Gon Jinn was very good in it. And Darth Maul was a great baddie. He was underutilised, but very good.
Can I just say, you two are throwing around these names and terms, and even the names of the prequel films, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
When you mentioned Doctor Who, and you talked to me all about Daleks and all the rest of it, I'm the same.
We don't do that on the podcast.
Japanese. You're talking Japanese, so it's fine.
When you mention the actual films, I know clearly in my mind which the first three, episodes 4, 5, 6, I know what they are. I can vaguely remember the story for each as distinct elements. I can vaguely remember what happens in the first three as one job lot, and same for the last part of the trilogy. But it's a blur for me. It doesn't really stick. And yet you two are much closer to being like the initiated, if you like, that know the stories, know the characters, can talk authoritatively, throw in terms like Ewoks and Satanic Pits, whatever that sandpit thing was.
Satanic
Sarlacc.
Pits?
Sarlacc
Pits. Sarlacc Pits.
See, you just made my case.
Well, look, getting back to Star Wars and New Hope, you say it takes a while to sort of build, Greg. I just sort of disagree. I don't think it takes a long time at all. I think you get introduced to all the characters. No, but it's not boring. I mean, you get a fair bit of action in there. And the characters, the build of the characters is fantastic. I mean, you get Darth Vader, who's dressed in quite an odd suit. I think his suit gets better in Empire Strikes Back. But
sure.
But Darth Vader and also the lightsaber fights are much better as the series
progresses. I would have cut big chunks of the journey out into the desert. I think there's a lot of just overlaying there. Oh, yes.
No, you need it, Greg. It builds it. It builds the world. It builds the characters.
I'd agree with you, Ricardo. The desert is really good. It really does build the characters.
Oh, you're both fanboys.
You know what? I'm not the biggest fan of this film. I love the film, but I think Empire Strikes Back's better. I think a few of even the new ones might be a bit better. But what this did was created the universe.
Yes, I agree.
So, you know, it's such a classic for that reason. I mean, the characters were so strong. And I think we're going to talk about it through all of these three films, how you know, your investment in the action comes directly from your love of the character and what they're going through. I mean, in Star Wars, the characters are so good and you're really following these characters, so you're really invested in their journey. Okay, so when the action hits, you're there. And the fact that it spawned such an amazing following for generations, you can't fault it. It's you know, never will it happen, you know, for a very long time. To think that before 1977 there was no Star Wars in the world. All my life, there's just been Star Wars. Star Wars has been there.
Ah, memories.
You to remember.
Yeah, for me, for you, it's before and after Star Wars. For me, it's before and after Superman with Christopher Reeve, which is only 2 years later, yeah. That was the first real blockbuster for me. And I don't want to sound too dark on Star Wars. I think it is a very good film, and the first one I really enjoyed and enjoyed again watching it recently with Sebastian. But it didn't speak to me in the way it obviously spoke to the two of you.
That end sequence when they're fighting with the Death Star and going through all of those, which were shot on miniatures, you know, yeah. It was all shot on miniatures. In the day, it was just not seen. I mean, what space films did we have, really, good ones back then? We had 2001 A Space Odyssey, which came out, which is very sort of existential and very sort of... surreal.
You had sci-fi films like The Day the Earth Stood Still and War of the Worlds, but they were typically... a lot of them were set on Earth, but then you had things like Forbidden Planet, but they were few and far between. And before 2001, you had Lost in Space on TV.
That's right, yeah. Well, you had those ones, but Star Wars was just...
Oh, there's no. You cannot compare Star Wars to Lost in Space in terms of technical excellence. There's no comparison.
Absolutely not. No comparison.
Do you know what's interesting about that is at the Oscars, Star Wars is really big news. You know, it had done so well, it had come out of nowhere. And George Lucas wouldn't have been that well known despite American Graffiti, I would imagine. And it won most of the technical awards, surprise, surprise. It won Best Score for John Williams. Williams or Williamson? Williams.
Williams.
And won Best Score for John Williams for the Star Wars theme, which is a very distinctive theme. And as you know, Ricardo, I don't necessarily pay attention to soundtracks in films, you know, musical soundtracks. But it lost Best Picture, Screenplay and Director to Annie Hall and Woody Allen.
Wow.
Which are chalk and cheese as far as films. I went back to check because, you know, sometimes...
They are, but Annie Hall's a very good movie. It is very good. And the thing is, I think Star Wars is great technically, and I think it's quite right, actually. I think some of the acting is not great. I don't think Luke is amazing in it, and I think some of the screenplay...
I actually think he's quite good.
Really.
For an out-of-nowhere actor, I think he absolutely hits the mark in terms of that enthused from the back of beyond... farm boy. I think he gets that quite right. And it's interesting over his career, as he's done darker roles, how Luke has grown in that direction as well.
Oh, I think
he's... But I think he's great in the first one.
Not really. I think yes, no, he grows. Really. He does grow. No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
He grows a lot in it. No, he's not that great. But he grows a lot in the series. Look, I'm not a massive fan of where they took Luke in the new trilogy. In The Last Jedi, I was completely against where they took Luke in that series. I think he just became a grumpy old man.
What do you think, Sebastian?
I'd agree with you, Ricardo. With the sequels, they just wiped out the original three of the original trilogy. You have Force Awakens, where they just kill off Han Solo, Last Jedi, where they kill off Luke, and then recently Rise of Skywalker. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen it yet, where Leia dies.
Well, I think the whole world knows that she died because the actress died. They didn't have a lot of choice.
Well, that's right. Mm. I loved The Force Awakens. I loved the opening. I didn't like The Last Jedi that much, but I didn't mind the last one, The Rise of Skywalker. But getting back to the first, it's a classic.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it. Even though it's probably not the best one, it is a classic. It started the whole thing. What are you going to give it, Sebastian?
Well, I'd give it a 9.5 out of 10. It's not my favourite one, which is Revenge of the Sith, but it's a very good film, and plus I'm a huge fan of Star Wars. And just, I feel like Luke was very well cast, as well as Han and Leia. And my only comment about Luke would be, after losing, well, the only family he had, I feel like there wasn't as much emotion as I would have thought to losing all your family.
I agree with that, actually. It was a bit absent.
Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. It wasn't the greatest performance. But that's his direction as well. I don't think Lucas is that great at directing actors. And I think that showed a lot in Hayden Christensen in Attack of the Clones and his performances there. I think he got better, Hayden, during Revenge of the Sith. But whereas, you know, in Attack of the Clones, he was not great. And there was a few scenes there where I just went, geez, if you were only directed. So
and what are you giving it, Ricardo?
Look, okay, I'm gonna do something here. I think the film itself on par is probably an 8, but I'm gonna give it a 10 because it started everything.
Well, my score is for the same reason as yours. It's a lower score for me. It's a 7.5. I think it's a fine film, but I boost it up for exactly the same reason. You know, my notes I wrote down when I was watching it was that it transformed the industry in so many ways, but also, as you just said, impacted lives across generations. You know, it created this whole universe that became something bigger than the original film.
Absolutely.
Sebastian, is there any last things you want to say about the film?
No, that's pretty much tied up.
Well, can I just say that you are officially our first ever guest on our podcast, and thank you for playing. And now for our second film, we want to welcome our second ever guest to the podcast, Cass, who's Ricardo's son. Cass, how are you going? Welcome.
Hello. I'm so excited to do this.
I know that you are excited, but we're going to give you a couple of minutes, or knowing your dad, hours to relax while your dad tells us about the film that you chose. Ricardo.
Based on the novel by Ernest Cline, Ready Player One pays homage to pop culture of mainly the 70s, 80s and 90s. And who better to direct a film like this than Steven Spielberg, who directed and produced so many classics in this time period. Jaws, Close Encounters, E.T., Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, Gremlins, the list goes on. The year is 2045. The place is Columbus, Ohio. People live on top of each other in the stacks, which look like a lot of stacked truck trailers. It's a low economic area. Our protagonist, Wade Watts, Ty Sheridan, lives here with his aunt and her boyfriend. To escape their lives, people find salvation in the Oasis, an ultra-large virtual reality universe created by James Halliday, Mark Rylance. When Halliday dies, he promises his entire fortune and full control of the Oasis to the first person who can discover three keys, leading to a digital Easter egg that's hidden somewhere in the Oasis. This is not just a video game. It's a way of life. When you accumulate anything in the Oasis and your avatar dies, you end up losing everything. IOI, Innovative Online Industries, headed by Sorrento, Ben Mendelsohn, wants the Oasis and its fortune, so employs many people to try and win this. Wade is up for the challenge. In trying one of these challenges, Wade meets Artemis, Olivia Cooke, a well-known gamer in this world. They work together and fall for each other while trying to beat every challenge, thus becoming a threat to IOI, who do their best to stop them. This is such a fun film, brilliantly directed by Steven Spielberg. It has many fantastic effects and action sequences, which is fun and good, but the characters are great. Spielberg never forgets that as an audience we are affected by the characters, and that the action is only thrilling when we're invested in the characters going through that action, which is beautifully shot by Janusz Kaminski. The retro references are in the hundreds, from King Kong, Freddy Krueger, Chucky from Child's Play, Back to the Future, The Shining, The Iron Giant, to Atari games. You can just keep watching this over and over and find more and more. This is accompanied by a wonderful score from Alan Silvestri, who plays amongst classic songs from artists such as Prince, Tears for Fears, Twisted Sister, Bruce Springsteen, The Bee Gees, Blondie. Again, the list goes on. Spielberg just proved with this film that he's still got it and still leads the pack when it comes to fun blockbuster entertainment. So, Cass, why did you choose Ready Player One?
I chose it because I've always had a love for VR video games and old video games, retro items and more.
So what did you discover in Ready Player One that you really loved, like retro?
Well, when looking at Artemis's bike, I noticed that I found an Atari logo next to the front wheel.
You know what? You spotted that. And I never spotted that. I'd seen it quite a few times. And this is the thing about this movie. You can sort of find references all the time. And yes, you found it on the bicycle wheel.
And
yes.
Cass, how many times have you seen this film?
Maybe 3 times.
Is that all? It sounded like you watched it many more times.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to say thank you, by the way, for choosing this film. Because I have seen it once before and I liked it. And because you chose it for this podcast, it meant that I had to go back and watch it again. And I started noticing a lot more of these things as well. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So, Greg, what did you spot in here? What did you like?
Well, you know I'm going to have to say this as a Doctor Who fanboy. I spotted the TARDIS. Now, when I say I spotted it, I was cheating. This time around, I found an article. I knew there were lots of Easter eggs in this film, little hidden things, like Easter eggs
absolutely.
In a video game, and which they make a great point of during the final challenge of Easter eggs going back to early Atari, so 70s, 80s, whenever it was. And so I knew that the film did that.
What was that?
It was 1977. I'm an expert at this stuff.
The same year that Star Wars came out. There you go. And the same year that your dad was born. So, Ricardo, look at all these things you caused to happen in the universe by just arriving. Anyway, moving right along. I knew that there were lots of things, just scattered across this film. And I have to say, my one real criticism of the film is that a little bit in the car race in the first challenge, but certainly in the big battle in the third challenge, I just get overwhelmed. There's too much going on. I'm trying to spot stuff, and it's just too much for me. My poor, ancient brain doesn't cope with that in the way that I suspect yours probably does, Cass. So I cheated this time. I had a little cheats guide about Easter eggs, and I was scrolling through it as I watched the film, trying to keep up. And the list said that there were 120 items. Now, I know there's a whole lot of stuff in the film they didn't list. So when your dad says there are hundreds of Easter eggs, there are at least hundreds. There's probably thousands. But I was really chuffed because I found out that the TARDIS from Doctor Who, the blue police box, is in this film.
Yes.
And it happens when, what's his name? It happens when Parsifal takes Artemis back to H's workshop the first time when H fixes the red motorbike.
Yes.
And if you go back and look carefully, what you'll see is that as they stand there talking about the motorbike, behind them, a little bit up on some sort of rack or staircase, is the TARDIS.
I'd never noticed.
No Daleks that I know of, but there's certainly the TARDIS. And that's what I love about it, because there is so much, there's something there for everyone. As long as you're vaguely tapped into popular culture, there's something there for everyone.
It is. Look, I think the action is so well done in it. Isn't that cool with King Kong, with their opening sequence going through with the motorbikes and all the cars and everything?
King Kong was in it?
Yes. It was the giant monkey that crashed the
horse. Oh, is that what that was? I couldn't work it out.
What's your favourite sequence in this, Cass?
I think it was when they were probably playing Atari at the end. They had an Atari game console, to be exact, the Atari 2600. And to be exact, the exact game that they used was my favourite Atari game, Adventure.
They must have seen you coming. What I liked about that sequence was everything in the film is so, so high tech, VR, computer graphics, everything else. And the whole challenge comes, we don't want to spoil the film too much, but the whole challenge comes to rest on this classic thing that you're talking about. What about you, Ricardo? What was your favourite bit?
Oh, it has to be The Shining. The recreation of The Shining is my favourite section of it. I think Spielberg would have had a ball doing that.
Well,
I mean,
he was
Spielberg,
a friend of Kubrick, wasn't he?
Yeah, a very good film, a friend of Kubrick's. I mean, Kubrick's favourite film apparently was E.T. And Kubrick was going to make artificial intelligence, AI,
That's right. I've forgotten. Yeah.
Yeah. And they'd talked about it. And when he died, I think that's why Spielberg made that and put a lot of Kubrick touches to it. So when you watch it, he's got a real, that's a real homage to Kubrick in there as well. in artificial intelligence. But that is my favourite sequence. They did it so well. I mean, the whole design of the sets and everything, the blood coming out of the elevators was perfect. Room 237. But that's not your real favourite part, is it? Is it, Kaz?
No, it isn't. The room 237 part, I had to watch it through my fingers because it's
like the boy in the film. The boy in the film says the same thing. He had to watch it through his fingers.
You're right. To be exact, the person who said it was Sho.
Thank you.
They put such good special effects in the zombie thing with a giant axe that I couldn't handle it. It's just way too freaky. What's yours, Greg?
I have two, and one of them is certainly the Stephen King hotel scenes. Not just in its own right as, you know, narrative and what's going on in the story, but exactly what your dad's saying, that it's so well done in terms of recreating that world of the movie with a lot of love. You can see the love almost pouring out of those scenes. And my other favourite part, I think, is earlier in the film, the dance hall, when they're dancing in the air.
Oh, fantastic. And the zombies.
Those zombies.
No, not the zombies. No, in the nightclub.
Oh, the Distracted Dome nightclub.
Yeah.
One of Halliday's first creations.
And when he does something and he gets a little John Travolta dance square with the lights and he's doing a number on that and she's doing it. That whole sequence when they first come in and everyone's dancing up in the air above them and then they kind of leap into it and they're swirling around and then they start dancing and then you get the John Travolta kind of sequence. I just thought that was beautiful. I wanted to be there dancing with them.
I'd find it freaky jumping into a giant pit. But I'd also find it fun in an anti-gravity chamber. One of the funny parts of the film is when Parsifal almost hit the button at the end of the film.
Oh, yes.
When Halliday was getting the Easter egg. Halliday said, "Try not to erase the whole of the Oasis on your first day."
Yeah,
that really cracked me up laughing.
That was very funny. And let me ask you a question. Who do you think Halliday was in that part of the film?
I think it was just a lost memory.
Right, okay. I was genuinely moved when he and the little boy version of him, when they both left the attic and he turns around to Parsifal and says something like, "Thank you for playing my game."
Yeah.
I felt genuinely moved. I don't remember if I felt that way the first time around, but I got teary, you know.
Well, I agree with that. One of my notes here is that the Halliday character and Mark Rylance is fantastic, and it is very moving. He does a very moving performance, and that, you're right, that moment is moving when he says, "Thank you for playing my game."
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Do you know who they wanted to play that part originally?
Who?
And I don't know if this would have been a great idea or an okay idea. They wanted Gene Wilder, because the story basically is Willy Wonka. You've got the guy who wants to pass on his dream enterprise to the next generation, for someone who's young enough to have the whole spirit and hope alive in him and respect the vision, and has a quest. In one case, it's the golden tickets and, if you like, surviving the chocolate factory. And in this case, it's the three challenges. But it is basically the Willy Wonka story.
Yeah, you're right.
So to have Gene Wilder play Halliday could have been great, or it might have been a little bit too much. But sadly, he had dementia, and by the time they got round to where they might want him, he couldn't remember his lines, and so he just wasn't able. But I think you're right. Mark Rylance is a great choice. He does it very well.
Oh, I think he's a great actor, Mark Rylance. But you know, we haven't talked about here, and that's Ben Mendelsohn. He's fantastic in this.
He is. He really is.
He's a really likeable and very good baddie.
I don't know. I call him likeable. He's enjoyable.
Oh, he's quite likeable. He's enjoyable. Yeah, he's enjoyable. Yeah.
And there's a little joke in there that I had to look up this time, because when Artemis looks at some of his back files when she's looking for something about two-thirds of the way through the film, and she finds something about Kegel exercises.
Yeah, that was funny.
Do you know what they are? I had to look it up. That's the kind of exercise you do when you have problems with your bladder and have to go to the toilet a lot. So it's a little throwaway joke that you've got to Google for most of us, like me, but it's a little throwaway joke about, you know, making fun of the bad guy in the film. And then when he gets kicked in the crotch towards the end of the film, through the touch suit, I thought, that can't be good for the Kegel exercises.
Now, that's funny.
Oh, do you know the Oasis, what it stands for? It's actually an acronym.
Ooh.
In the book, not in the film. It stands for, I'm going to read this very carefully, ontologically anthropocentric sensory immersive simulation.
I have no idea what that means, but okay.
I can just about translate it after many years of reading stuff, but it is hard, I grant you. So, Cass, here's my big question. If the Oasis really existed, and if we could really go into it and do all these fun, fantastic, adventurous things, and have an avatar, which is any character we like throughout pop culture history, who do you think you would choose?
I think I'd choose a customised Minecraft avatar to fit my personality.
And what would that be?
Maybe a computer head. Computer-headed human.
And look, I want to just bring this to you, that Cass is very into old retro computers.
I know.
I know about the Apple IIe, which is pretty old. One of my good old favourites is the Macintosh Classic 1984. I've been into them for a few years, and I'm pretty good at explaining that stuff.
And what about you, Dad? What would you go for?
You know what? I loved He-Man growing up, and I'd probably be He-Man.
Woo!
The master of the universe!
Does He-Man actually turn up in the film at all?
Oh, geez, you know what? I'd have to watch it again to try and find out.
I know that apparently Ultraman was figured very strongly in the book, but they couldn't get the rights. They did a lot of negotiation over rights of all the different characters and guns and whatever else over a number of years to get to the point of being able to make the film they wanted to. I'll tell you something I did learn about all the different characters. I think that the animators in the film had a lot of fun playing a game with Steven Spielberg, because Spielberg said that he didn't want the film to reference his characters, that he didn't want to be accused of, you know, vanity. And with the notable exception of the DeLorean car out of Back to the Future, he said, okay, that makes sense and it's pivotal in the plot and so on, but don't use my stuff. Let's make it about other stuff. And yet the animators snuck stuff in. So at one stage you see a gremlin, and I think before and after the transformation, like a good and a bad gremlin.
Yeah, you do.
Did you notice the other reference to the gremlins in the film? It had to do with the magic orb.
No.
I only know this because of my cheat sheet.
Oh, hang on a minute. Something after midnight? No?
No. When, what's the bad guy's name? IROC 10 or something? What's his name?
Sorrento.
No, the other guy. It's IROC?
Oh.
Oh, IROC.
Okay.
I don't really like his avatar.
But he was funny, though.
Yeah, it was funny, just I didn't really like his avatar. Skull's in the wrong place.
You just know that IROC is living in his mum's basement in real life, don't you? But when IROC first shows the magic orb to Sorrento, and it's underneath, is it Perseus's shield or something, it's in a box, and he opens the box and takes the orb out. The box is the box that Billy's dad first brings a gremlin home in, that he opens up and sees
the
gremlin for the first
time. I think
it was a bit of a game. And there was some that Spielberg noticed towards the end of production, and he said, oh, look, it's too late to take it out. Look, leave it, it's fine. But there were others he didn't notice, like the box, that found its way in. And I reckon, and I so hope it's true, I reckon that they were playing games, let's see what we can sneak past the boss kind of game. And I think that if that's true, that's just fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the film to do it in.
Do you know why the company's called IOI?
Why?
Apparently, it's because it's the game Pong. Have you ever played Pong? Where you've got
Pong.
The two bats and the
oh
ball.
Oh, my God.
It's the bat, the
oh,
ball,
yeah.
And the bat, IOI. That itself is a reference, apparently, to retro technology.
Oh, my God, I know that. And also, it also sort of represents a TIE fighter from Star Wars, like, seriously.
Oh, it does too. You're right. I hadn't thought of that. You're spot on. Now, I need to pick you up on one little thing, Ricardo, from your introduction. You rattled off all those 80s singers like Prince and so on that were used in the film. You missed out.
Yes.
You missed out Van Halen for Jump.
Oh, look, I said, and the list goes on.
Yes.
And yes, there's yes,
which
but there
opens
is
it up.
Van Halen in there as well.
But I've
yes.
got another Easter egg for you about the
What's
music.
What's that? Jeepers, another one.
I have to say, I was a bit disappointed by the end titles. I thought they were a bit boring. I thought a lot more could have been done with that, but maybe they just wanted to make it more like the end of an 80s film. I don't know.
Oh, come on, Greg. They put so much in the movie.
Yeah.
So much.
I want it in the
nothing
credits.
Nothing on the plate in that movie. And so, oh, the credits were boring. Oh, my goodness.
But what was the last song when the credits started? Do you remember?
Do you remember?
No, I don't.
I don't either.
You Make My Dreams is a Hall & Oates. You make my dreams come true. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Do you know why they chose that? I know why they chose that song.
Why?
Because that is the song that was played when the author of the book, Ernest Cline, and his wife walked down the aisle together for their wedding. And when Spielberg knew that, he said, that's what we're going to use. I think that's lovely.
Oh, well, that's actually quite nice.
And
that's, that is.
That's one of the things I love about this film. And again, Cass, thank you for choosing it. Because every now and then on the podcast, if a film intrigues me, I go away and start reading about it. And this was absolutely a case of that. And what I love about this film is there's so much stuff just woven through everything, you know, down to the choice of the songs and the little characters on the side where you see the DC superheroes in the different outfits. I think it was such a great choice.
At the end of the movie, I noticed some certain old retro computers, one of which that I don't know what it is. That's the system that little Halliday at the end of the movie was playing on. But I did notice two other retro material in when Halliday was searching for the Easter egg under his desk.
Yeah.
I noticed a crystal radio set. Some people don't know what it is. It's an old radio set that uses a crystal to actually get the broadcast right.
Yeah.
They plug in with headphones. Some kids use them. Some kids don't listen to radio on them. I think it's a build-it-yourself. Yeah, I also noticed a computer. I think it's a IBM PC Junior with a Commodore Amiga 1000 monitor.
I will so have to take your word for that.
It's interesting because, you know, I know a lot of these references, and so do you, Greg. But Cass hasn't seen Child's Play, obviously.
Good.
But how did you find the character of Chucky?
Chucky, he didn't look scary at all. They did better animation at the creepy zombie thing than Chucky. I don't know how that's possible, but they did this really non-creepy animation for Chucky.
Did you notice Freddy Krueger?
Not at all.
Oh, really?
Spot him early on when we're first seeing him for the first time. He's in his world. He's shooting up a lot of
locating
war.
Locating H. Sector 12, Planet Doom.
That's the one. That's right. And H shoots Freddy Krueger.
I didn't notice that. I was just focusing on H with the really absurd gun shooting other people, turning them into gold coins, which in real life, that would just be very non-horrific.
I actually thought the gold coins was a really nice touch because instead of blood spurting out of characters or something graphic, which would mean a lot of the audience might not be allowed to go and see it because of their parents, the gold coins, which was the metaphor of what was really going on in the real world, you know, lost all their money, was actually a very clever visual device to make the story more acceptable. Yeah.
And what other retro things did you find there, Cass?
At the very, very end of the movie, in Wade and Samantha's apartment room, I spotted a Space Invaders arcade machine.
Cool.
Amazing.
I did find some interesting information about one Atari game called Pitfall. One of the characters in the movie, one of the IOI workers, said, "Pitfall, one of the only Atari games that still has an ending."
Well, you know, Cass loves the Atari and plays a lot of Atari games, and we've played E.T. That's definitely known as the worst game ever made, which Spielberg had a hand in.
In the game.
They had a designer who designed for Atari, did a lot of brilliant, did Breakout, didn't he?
One of the designers of Atari also was an Apple worker.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the most famous Apple workers, the one who actually released the Macintosh.
Steve Jobs. Yeah.
I've heard of him.
But the designer of the E.T. game was another designer who designed some other games.
Oh, yeah, like Yara's Revenge. That's a really good game. It's about you being a little, like I think it's a moth, and you've got to try and defeat this evil source with a giant force field and just try and kill it.
And so that's Yara's Revenge. So he had a lot of big, big games, and they got him to do E.T. in 5 weeks.
You've got to say, for the coding of the game in 5 weeks, it's actually not bad. And I heard that there was some Easter eggs. Like, the creator's first game was Indiana Jones Raider of the Lost Ark. You can actually spawn in a little Indiana Jones figure.
Cass, I've got some more Easter eggs for you. I've got two left on my list. when you see that Halliday has died and he's in that video where he's pretending to be dead in the coffin and he sits up early in the film, the coffin is the coffin from Mr. Spock from one of the Star Trek films. And in fact, if you look closely, there's one, possibly two flower creations either side of the coffin that are the Star Trek insignia, like the badge.
Oh.
And the second one
I've never watched Star Trek, so...
Oh, well, it's time. It's time.
I should watch it soon. I should watch it soon, though.
And the other one is, have you seen Blade Runner?
I have. No, okay. Chris hasn't.
Not yet. So
I've heard of it, but I haven't ever seen it.
I have to say, I also love the scene when they hack Sorrento's hamster wheel pod.
Rick.
Rick, thank you. And he's still inside Oasis but doesn't realise.
Yeah, I thought that's fantastic.
That's very clever. But there's a clue in that scene that... So you've got Parsifal and what's the other chap's name, Cass?
Dito.
You've got Parsifal and Dito holding guns on Sorrento while he's in his rig, right?
Yeah.
If you go back and watch it again and look carefully, what you'll see is that in the eyes of Dito and Parsifal, their eyes have this funny kind of orange-white glint, like a reflection almost. And that's a reference to the replicants from the Blade Runner film, which are artificial people, like robot people. So again, that's what I love about this film. There is all this stuff just woven all through. You're going to have to go back and watch this film again now because of our conversation and see all these other things that are still there for all of us to discover. It's terrific. Great choice. So, Cass, you probably know that we have a tradition on this podcast of asking you to rate the film out of 10 and why. What will you give this film?
I think for the good graphics, representative of my interests and a lot of other things, I think I'd give it maybe a 9.5 out of 10.
That's exactly what Sebastian gave for Star Wars just before.
That's funny.
I'm going to go next. I think it's an 8 out of 10. There's some bits I'm just a bit overwhelmed by, like particularly the last battle, and that just makes it all a bit of a blur for me. But I have to say, in the middle of all that, what I did like was all the people out on the street in the real world who were fighting and running with the goggles on. I'm not quite sure how that worked with their bodies in the Oasis, given that they didn't have all that full body gear that Parsifal had, but I still loved that. But that scene, I was kind of like a bit over it. I think there's more in there for you than there is for me. But there, as I keep saying, there's so much in this film that's there waiting to be seen next time around. It's just crammed not only with a lot of characters and pop culture references, but therefore it's crammed with a lot of love from all the people who worked on this film. So for me, yeah, it's 8 out of 10. What about you, Ricardo?
Yeah, snap. 8 out of 10 for me. I remember when I first saw the trailer for this film and I didn't know what it was about. I knew it had pop cultural references in it, but it didn't have a story in the trailer that much. And I wasn't that intrigued, to tell you the truth. I thought it was great effects-wise. But then I thought, in the back of my mind, Spielberg's doing it. So when I finally saw it, I really enjoyed it. But I'm enjoying it even more and more.
I enjoyed it more second time around too.
Yeah, more and more. You spot more things. You're looking in the background, seeing what you can find. And look, it's loaded. And I've seen it quite a few times, 5 or 6 times or something now, and I'm still finding things now. It was one of the best blockbuster films of 2018, I think. And yeah, 8 out of 10, absolutely.
Well, Cass, we want to thank you so much for coming on. You are our second ever guest. Just pipped by half an hour by Sebastian. And this is a big thing for us. It's usually just the two of us. And I don't know about Ricardo, but I get bored of him. So it's great to have it's great to have someone new in here. But I want to finish on a really happy note for you. I've got some news. Apparently, they're thinking about the sequel.
They're building a sequel?
Well, these things sometimes happen, sometimes they don't. But that's the plan, apparently. So that's great news.
Maybe it's going to be called Ready Player 2.
I think it's actually going to be called Ready Player 1-2.
So our third film we're going to discuss is 1995's film, The Usual Suspects, which was chosen by Teo. How are you going, Teo?
Oh, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Greg, do you want to lead us in to The Usual Suspects?
Well, the first thing we should say about this 1995 film is that it has a big twist, which we should do our best to avoid revealing, difficult though I think that's going to be.
Agree.
Yeah, the film opens with Dean Keaton, Gabriel Byrne, an injured criminal compassionately allowed a last cigarette on a trawler before we hear a shot fired and the trawler set on fire. Ostensibly by a figure that director Brian Singer keeps carefully out of frame and low-voiced. Verbal Kint, Kevin Spacey, is one of two survivors of the trawler's nighttime assault, during which 27 men were killed. Next day, he's questioned about the event by US Customs agent Dave Kuyan, Chaz Pamancheri. Under pressure, Verbal, so named because he talks a lot, eventually reveals the sequence of events leading up to the massacre, with the story of how he, Keaton and three other criminals, Stephen Baldwin, Kevin Pollack, and a barely intelligible Benicio del Toro, were rounded up 6 weeks ago for someone else's crime. The five all meet for the first time in the lineup and jail cell, and then form a gang in resentment against the injustice of being treated as the usual suspects, in a reference to a famous line from Casablanca. They pull a couple of jobs that become violent until they're summoned by Kobayashi, Pete Postlethwaite, a lawyer working for a mysterious and ruthless criminal myth, Kaiser Sose. Kobayashi tells them that they have all unintentionally stolen from Sose's criminal network and are now required to rob a rival gang's trawler to make amends. Or else. On my first viewing, I found the early narrative confusing and just had to go with the flow. But it crystallizes around the central question of Kaiser's identity. Does he really exist? Has he been guiding events all the way along, including that initial lineup, to suit his criminal purposes? Is he someone we've encountered in the film, male or female, perhaps even a member of the gang? Agent Kuyan is convinced that Kaiser is Keaton, who has form in faking his own death through fire, and he pressures Verbal to corroborate his belief. When an answer finally comes at the end of the film, it's completely unexpected. There's a particularly startling revelation provided by the dropping of a coffee mug. I say this as someone who prides himself on picking whodunits in books and movies, but completely failed to do so here. But unlike some whodunit twists, the usual suspects had played completely fair throughout, and I realised how skillfully the narrative had been spun, dancing between truth and self-serving lies and myth-making. It's a masterclass in storytelling in a pretty tight 100 minutes. A quarter of a century later, it rewards a second viewing, as you pick up clues throughout the narrative to which you were previously oblivious. This, in fact, was Singer's intent. He described his film as Double Indemnity meets Rashomon, made so you can go back and see all sorts of things you didn't realise were there the first time. You can get it a second time in a way you never could have the first time around. And, by the way, if you're interested, we reviewed Rashomon back in Season 1, Episode 5. Christopher McQuarrie deservedly won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, and the Writers Guild of America ranked the film as having the 35th greatest screenplay of all time. Kevin Spacey won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, and he's terrific, although I find it hard now to watch his performances with distance from his recent history, in the same way I was quite struck by seeing the World Trade Center Twin Towers in the background at one point. So, Teo, I know you've seen this film more than a couple of times. What's its fascination for you?
I think why I chose this film is because of all the films I've watched, and granted it's far less than the two of you have seen, it's by far the most rewatchable film I've ever seen. And, you know, the first time you watch it, you're blown away by the end, and you go back and watch it not long after to see what you can catch. And the times after that, you start turning to, well, I found myself start turning to the internet and pointing out the bits that I've missed, and I can go back and find them. So I just find it so rewatchable, unlike any film I've ever seen.
How many times have you watched it?
I think this was my fifth time.
Mm. You know, in some ways, that's a bit like the film we just spoke about with Cass, Ricardo's son, about how there's so much in it that you do go back and you watch it repeatedly, and you get something out of it every time.
When that came out, it was really in my first year uni. I really started in 96. I started really watching it, and I'd seen it quite a lot of times, Teo. And I was blown away by it, like you are now. And I couldn't stop watching it. I think the pace of the film from the beginning, I found that if I start the movie, I cannot stop watching it. Everybody's at their best, really, in this film. Gabrielle Byrne is phenomenal. Stephen Baldwin was never as great as what he was in this movie.
I agree, actually, yeah.
You know, but the screenplay, it all comes down to the screenplay, is a marvel, the way that weaves itself together. it's phenomenal. It really is. It's one of the best screenplays. But it's also its style, which Singer brings to it. And he says Double Indemnity. It is a noir film. And so when I saw it, that style just oozes from this film, unlike the films which were coming out at that time as well.
Performances are wonderful. It's called a neo-noir film.
Well, it is. Yeah. And even the score. The score is very old school, sort of a mystery thriller.
Mm.
It's a wonder, this movie. It really is. I loved watching it again. I hadn't seen it for many years, but I remember watching it many, many times. But it was great to watch it again after so many years to rewatch. I fell in love with it again.
There's some great cinematography in this film too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The one that I always remember is when they're on the beach burying someone in the mouth of a cave, and the shot is from inside the cave to all of them standing framed by the cave's mouth in front of the ocean. On a well moonlit night. It's just a very striking scene. And I remember that from the first time as well. But the thing I noticed this time is the first time you see the damage to the trawler, the shot is what I assume is like a raising crane shot beyond that little kind of building to go over the roof and then see the trawler and smoke, I think, pouring out of it.
Mm.
And then later in the film, when you first really see the beginning of the assault on the trawler, you get that same shot at night now rather than day, but the same raising shot over the roof of that building to see the trawler, you know, relatively normal. It's a really nice linking of those two states in the film.
Mm. It's unlike, you know what I love about it? It's also, yes, there is a twist and whatnot at the end. I find that with those sorts of movies, and I'll mention one, which is like, Shyamalan loves to do twists. M. Night Shyamalan loves to do twists in his movies. I remember I liked The Village, you know, but once you know that twist in The Village, I don't rewatch it. I haven't rewatched it again, and I've tried, and I can't because it's not scary anymore.
I think you can with The Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense, you can, and Unbreakable, you can to a sense there as well. But a lot of films with big twists.
Once you've had it. And I really think that in the end, once you know the answer to the central mystery, and then when you go back and watch it, you start to realise not only about all the clues to what's going on that you just miss because it's so skillfully done, but you also start to realise that you don't really know where truth is.
Mm.
So when you see the opening scene, when it looks like Keaton might have been shot, but it's done deliberately from a distance, so you hear the shot, but you don't actually see what happens in that moment. Then when you hear the story being told across the narrative of the film, you take a lot of stuff on trust, but on the subsequent viewings you realise, hang on, that's not necessarily what happened. And that's why it's like Rashomon. It's those different perspectives where you're not quite sure what the truth is. And even when you find out the answer, and you think back to what you heard in the story, some of that is probably true, but you know other parts are being played with, and you know there's that great scene towards the end with the dropped coffee mug when you realise the different things that have formed the story in that room. That's really well done as well. You actually have no idea what really, really happened.
It's probably one of, if not the first film I watched and really took in cinematography, because usually, I saw it a while ago the first time and I was just there for watching the film. I wasn't caring, but like you said, the shot of the beach is amazing. At the very start when the ship's horn blares, you're almost like, oh god, the film going on. I'm not really one for scores, but that really had me going. I quite like the artistry of this film, and it's amazing to see. It's one of the first films I also remember where I pick up people that I knew from other stuff. So Chaz Parmenteri, I knew from one of the Call of Duty games, actually. He voices a role in one of the Zombies games, which is amazing. Kevin Spacey is just one of those faces.
That's such a generational thing. Mm. I first saw Chaz Parmenteri in Robert De Niro's directorial debut, A Bronx Tale. Which is a wonderful film. In fact, Greg, we should do that. It's a really good film, and it's a good father-son gangster film.
We're gangster, Teo.
Yeah. But he did a one-man show on Broadway, and they made the feature, and he played all the characters in this movie. But De Niro picked it up, and they made the feature. And it's a really good movie. That's when I first saw him. So so then after that, obviously seeing him in this, I love just his performance and his presence from that. So it's interesting to hear that your first presence for him was in a game, which is quite generational. Well,
In that, he plays a mobster trapped in Alcatraz with four others. And in that, he's kind of the mastermind, and he's really good in that. So I picked him up his voice because his face is in the game, but it's slightly different. But that even this time watching, I realized the guy who plays Jack Bayer, the FBI agent, he was in The Godfather of Harlem, one of the new Stan series.
That's Giancarlo Esposito.
Yeah, yeah. He's quite good in that, and he's completely different to the role he plays in this. And it's just every single actor in that film does it so well. I can't think of someone I went, oh, gee. Even the Hungarian, burnt in the hospital bed, does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not a bad... All the small characters are important, and all of them have a role, and all of them are good. You know, they do something with their roles. It's a real gem, this. It's a real gem of a film. Not many come out that are like it. I mean, did it win any Oscars? I mean, did it get nominated for anything else other than, like, the best actor? Or get? I know Kevin Spacey got Best Supporting, but did it get nominated for anything else? Or?
Well, Best Screenplay. But beyond that, no. So if you look at...
One Best Screenplay, though, yes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Best Original Screenplay, yes. So if you look at the actor nominations, Nicolas Cage wins for Leaving Las Vegas.
Okay, that was a very good performance.
Yeah, then you get Richard Dreyfuss as Mr. Holland's Opus, Anthony Hopkins for Nixon, Sean Penn in Dead Man Walking, and the guy from Il Postino.
On that, there's not really someone you can nominate from the film for Best Lead Actor. They're all supporting.
Agreed.
Spacey won over the James Cromwell for Babe, Ed Harris for Apollo 13, Brad Pitt for 12 Monkeys, and Tim Roth for Rob Roy.
He really deserved it for that.
No female nominations, probably because there's only one minor female character in this film as well. And in fact, it's interesting, all three films that our sons chose have very low female profiles in the stories.
That's true, actually.
In the original Star Wars, you've got Princess Leia, obviously. You get a brief appearance from Luke Skywalker's aunt before she's bumped off by the baddies. In Ready Player One, there are more female characters.
Artemis is the main.
Then H, you don't realise at first, spoiler alert, is actually a woman. So there are more female characters. There's Kira, who's the long-lost love of Halliday and so on. So they do have those. But then here, you've got the female lawyer, who is Keaton's girlfriend, and that who's not a very big part, and that's it, I think. It's very much a man's world. And then not nominated for art direction, not nominated for cinematography, which is interesting. It was up against Braveheart, which won, and then Batman Forever, A Little Princess, which is interesting, Sense and Sensibility, and something called Shanghai Triad. Do you know that?
Batman Forever?
Yeah. Which one was that? Was that the...
Batman Forever was nominated for...
Was that the Arnie one?
No, that was the Jim Carrey.
Oh, Best Cinematography.
Oh, well, I must say, actually, yeah, I think Batman Forever gets a bad rap because of Batman and Robin. It's actually not as bad as people think. It's actually not that bad.
Yeah.
And in fact, its colour is wonderful, actually.
And then for directing, Mel Gibson won for Braveheart. That was really his year. You know, I get that.
It was, actually. Yeah, it was. You've seen Braveheart, haven't you, Teo?
No, I haven't.
No, neither have I.
Oh, you've got to see Braveheart. Yeah.
And then the other four were Babe, Dead Man Walking, Leaving Las Vegas, and Il Postino. So I think that Singer was a bit shortchanged there.
Absolutely he was, yes. I would absolutely put that over Il Postino. I would put it over quite a few of those, actually.
I'd probably be with you. So it's a film that probably didn't get its due at the time, although certainly the script. I mean, the script is the absolute standout.
Yeah, you've chosen quite a hard one to talk about, Taylor, because we're trying so hard not to give anything away here, because I find this now, because it's a generational thing as well. I mean, the fact that you've seen it is wonderful. I find that as time's gone, and it's been, you know, how long? It's been 25 years.
Quarter of a century.
Right? So the people who knew, like all of us who knew the twist in it, a lot of people growing up now don't really haven't heard of it and haven't seen it, so have no idea of that twist. So
every time I mention, oh, I love this film to someone my age, they go, I haven't heard of it, and I go, oh,
there we go,
yeah,
Yeah, absolutely. And that, isn't that fantastic? Mm. It's like The Crying Game. You know, that's got a big twist in it.
It's got a big reveal, hasn't it?
It's got a very big reveal. But nowadays, I mean, back you know, 10, 15 years ago, everybody knew what the twist was in The Crying Game. But now, the younger generation growing up have no idea. And so these are great little...
Well, that could be
these
true.
These are great films.
That could be true of The Sixth Sense too, actually.
Yeah, absolutely, because that was done in 99. Mm. So, yes.
I've seen The Crying Game, and I didn't enjoy it anywhere near as much as I enjoyed this one, to be fair.
No, it's a very different film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Have you seen The Sixth Sense?
No. Someone spoiled it for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it spoiled for me too. I hated that. The other thing is it's a great introduction of a very, if you like, seminal character, Kaiser Sose, in that the first time we see him, and we don't see a lot of him, but his introduction on that trawler at night is that he urinates on a trail of flame to put it out. Even
yes.
though that flame is going to destroy the trawler, which is his aim, he's not ready for that yet. So he's like, it's all about control.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I can't say to what I'm going to refer to now because I can't do that without spoiling the twist. But there is, I think, a direct quote of that scene in a much more recent work on TV. I'll tell you offline.
Well, the other thing I quite love about this film is how much I read about it and the backstory of it being made at the time. So when Gabriel Byrne found out about the ending, he stormed off the set and had to be calmed
really?
Down.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. He stormed off. He couldn't believe it.
Oh, wow.
Quite a funny note, I remember every time, that iconic scene in the lineup,
yes,
apparently when they
I know
were filming it, Benicio del Toro could not stop farting and it made every one of them crack up and they couldn't get the scene. It was originally meant to be a very serious scene,
yeah.
but they just went with the laughter.
And in fact, at one stage, didn't they all get told off by Bryan Singer?
Yeah, they did.
And they couldn't restore order, so they had to use it as that, you know, where they're just... You know,
and
laughing.
I think it's much better than the
laughing.
That is actually, it seems so real that it seems very real. Yeah. So it doesn't surprise me that.
Well, I crack up every time Benicio del Toro speaks in that scene. He's just the pause before and everyone smirks because they know what's coming.
Well, you know that, you know, his character is very hard to understand. And that was a deliberate artistic decision made between him and Bryan Singer because... Once he realised the purpose of that character in the plot, which I won't actually say what it is, but once he realised the purpose of that character, he realised it didn't much matter what he actually said. So he just made up this, like, you know, impenetrable accent.
Yeah.
It's a nice touch.
The other very interesting thing, and I'm trying to tread carefully without spoiling it, but
The butler, wasn't it?
All five of the main gang, when they were making the film or in the process, were led to believe that they were... Kaiser Soze.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they all were told and then it just came out through the filming process.
This is my boy. I'm very proud of my film geek son.
Well, I can't say I did this for many other films at all, but this one I just found myself delving into the backstory behind it.
But a good film does that. In fact, I was talking about it in the earlier part with Cass. When a film really kind of grabs you, it intrigues you, or you just think that's so interesting or well done, or what did that mean? And you start reading up around the film, the making of the film, there's that whole other layer. It's just fantastic.
I agree.
That happens with books. Maybe because a book is a solo act versus a teen kind of thing. So, Teo, we start with you. What rating do you want to give this out of 10?
I think it's very clear I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. It's definitely amongst... When someone asks me, what's your favourite film, it's this and some others.
What else?
Well, I love... And, you know, it's a bit crass, but Old School.
That's Will Ferrell?
Oh, yeah.
Will Ferrell, yep. I really loved Uncut Gems, the new Netflix one with Adam Sandler.
Which you've seen, but I haven't seen. Yeah.
I've seen it. Phenomenal, that one. And that's another film where I delved into the backstory of it because, not to go off track, but Kevin Garnett wasn't their first choice in that one, the basketball player.
Right.
But it's
Shawshank?
Old School. Shawshank's up there. It's not very much my favourite, but if I can split favourite and best films, it's one of the best films I've seen, but it's not one of my favourites, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then I quite enjoy a couple of Tarantino's films, but it's always this one that comes up first for me.
And Ricardo, what about you?
10. Yeah, it's a perfect film. There's not much I can fault on it from every department. From screenplay, obviously it always comes down to the screenplay. You've got Great directing. I mean, I don't think Bryan Singer hasn't made a better film since.
No. And I don't think Macquarie's written an equivalent script either.
Every department in a movie has to work very well, and it all comes down to a great script. But you've got even if you've got a great script, you still need your directorial departments, your cinematographers to work well together. You still need your editor to understand what their vision is to get it right when you after you show. So every department when you has to work in sync. And some films will have a great screenplay but just aren't great because there's something went wrong in the production of it, you know. And so, you know, films are very, you know, difficult to make, and, you know, films which don't have a lot of pre-production obviously sometimes find faults in the production, and then once you find faults in the production, they're trying to fix it in post. It's hard to make a perfect film, and this film is one of those films which obviously it all just came together and it's a perfect film.
Well, Christopher McQuarrie and Bryan Singer were childhood friends, so they were very knitted. And I think that comes through. But what's interesting, is since The Usual Suspects, most, not all, but most of the films he's actually written have been for Tom Cruise. So it's Valkyrie, it's Jack Reacher, Edge of Tomorrow, a few Mission Impossibles, and The Mummy and the Top Gun remake. So, there or sequel. You know, I was going to give this film a 9, but actually, talking about it, I think it is a 10. I can't think of anything where I would critique it. And like we said for Ready Player One, I don't know that I would watch this again and again and again, but I do think it does reward repeat viewing, and that makes it something really quite special.
So thanks, Teo, for choosing that. It was a great to rewatch.
Thanks for having me. Did my film get the best aggregate score of the three?
It did.
Yeah, good.
It's got a perfect score, 3/10.
Yeah.
Whereas for the others, let me think. So that's 27 and 27.5. So it edges up over the others, yeah.
Yeah, good. I'll be rubbing that in Sebastian's face for a while.
Well, it's been really lovely having you on.
So that concludes episode 3 of season 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. Wasn't it wonderful having our three sons on here, Greg?
I think we'll look back on this as being, you know, one of those special highlights. I don't know about our audience, but for us, you know, it that old phrase, it warmed the cockles of my heart.
Yes. I mean, look, you know, they have known, or my son has known, and yours have as well, Greg, that, you know, we've had this podcast. And so, you know, it takes time for us to do this, and time takes away from them sometimes.
Yes.
So it was really special, and I knew it was special for Cass as well to be a part of that.
And I know he was very excited by it.
Yeah.
Part of our intent was just to spend time sitting down, not only in this now, but also the watching of the films.
Absolutely. You know, and that was wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was great. He was writing notes. He was writing all his notes while he was watching the movie. And
he had flashcards.
He did have flashcards. And, you know, I didn't have to prompt him to do that. He was just doing it, you know. And so it was great anyway. It was a wonderful experience.
So perhaps we should have called this episode the podcast, The Next Generation. Well, speaking of snappy titles...
That's
why don't
right.
we talk about next episode?
Well, the next episode is we are going to call A Fistful of Oscars, Greg.
In preparing for this season, we discovered that in the history of the Oscars, there's only 3 films that have ever won what are called the top 5 awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay. So that's a bit of a pity for the people who were supporting actors and actresses and cinematographers, but let's roll with it. We're not actually going to tell you what these 3 films are. We think part of the fun is for you to try and think about that and guess it, but maybe we'll tell you what decades they were from. The first film is in the 1930s, the second film is in the 1970s, and the third film is from the 1990s. Now, I have seen 2 of these 3 films before.
I've seen one. No, sorry. I've seen 2.
Yeah, I suspect they're probably the same 2, the 1970s and 1990s ones.
That's the one.
And I'm actually looking forward to seeing the 1930s one. It's one I've often heard about. It's one of my favourite directors, I think, but I've never actually seen this film. So that's what to look forward to is A Fistful of Oscars. Have a bit of a think about what those films might be. We'll reveal it gradually across the episode next time. And if you want to, hop onto our Facebook page and post some guesses. But no pre-Googling. It's just guesswork.
So thank you very much for listening to us and our boys, and we hope you're enjoying our season 4. So looking forward to the next one.
See you later.